Hey, Shaq, how are you doing, brother? Welcome to
I'm
my
doing.
podcast.
Thank
It's
you,
the
Olmstead.
inaugural episode of the Ohm Show. I have been
Ohm Show.
ignoring it for so long, and I thought it would be great to start off with one of my favorite people on the internet. Not to mention my favorite people in life, too.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say, and I'm very honored to have the opportunity. You know, it's interesting. We live in a world where I find we talk less and less. We say a lot more, and whether that's messaging or blogging or tweeting or updating, but voice is missing sometimes in our life. So it's nice to be able to get a chance to communicate using voice.
And absolutely. So, what I would love to know is, the story of Shaq. I think we've known each other for almost a decade, but we've never really talked about our past. And, my life is a little bit, an open book, but I don't know much about you. So, I thought it would be a great opportunity to just chat with you about who you are, where you come from. And how did you get to where you are? And, not necessarily a story about the morality or anything of that sort, but we have our journey, and the journey is what I'm more interested in knowing. How did you become, who you are? So tell me, first of all, who you are right now. What do you do, and what is your claim to fame? And then we will go back in time.
Okay. Wow, so many questions and journeys and life and who we are. Fascinating. So right now, Orm, and this may come as a, I guess, a surprise to many of your listeners, although many of our mutual friends are aware, and obviously you are aware of it. Right now, I am a 43-year-old male living in London, recovering from a heart attack 5 months ago, which I'm sure then will lead us on to so many other questions. But you know, that's who I am, right? So forget claim to fame, forget what I've done work-wise and what I may not have done. Reality at the moment is I am an individual, great to be alive. Hopefully, what I would like to be regarded as a second chance. And you know, a lot more fortunate in terms of health and the fact that I am here having this phone call with you with than probably 99 point something of the world population. So that I hope explains in some shape or form who I am today.
So, for those of the people who don't know you, you are the, the guy, one of the guys behind student.com, which is a startup based in London, which helps overseas students helps them find, a lot of things they need to go and study in foreign countries, especially in United Kingdom. And your current focuses that company, but in the past, you worked on a few other ventures, including you were one of the early people at Spotify. And so that's how I know you from your Spotify work, and got to know you well because of that. And I think the reason you and I get along a lot is because you have a very interesting story. Your journey is what is interesting. Like you have, like me, you don't have any, Ivy League education. You didn't grow up in a privileged environment. So I want to know about the Shaq's hustle going forward. But before we do that, let's talk about your heart attack. How are you feeling now?
I'm feeling much better, thank you. And you know, I often think back to the phone calls or the messages or the dinners where we used to have, where I would sneak out midway to say, "Hey, I need to make a phone call," or whatever else, when I was actually going for a cigarette. And you were one of the very few people who used to tell me, you need to stop this shit, it'll kill you one day. But as most smokers will say, it's sometimes basically that's what it takes to realize that, hey, this is going to kill you. And, so I often think back to those days. But yeah, today, if I was to explain how do I feel, I do cardio rehab 3 times a week. I do yoga twice, sometimes 3 times a week. I have obviously stopped smoking. I went to a great hypnotist, spent 4 hours and haven't smoked since. That's actually been 4.5 months now. So all the right things, I'm spending all my time on some form or other activity which helps my recovery. So I am not working in the sense I don't go to an office. I don't have operational roles anywhere because the reality is, hey, this is the most important thing in my life right now. And I love life and I want to live a healthy life going forward. So I will do whatever it takes in my means and power to try and make a full and healthy recovery.
The interesting part of the smoking is that, like you, I smoked for what, close to 27 years, and I quit pretty much overnight after I got sick. I had my own heart condition and my own heart attack 10 years ago. And, it kind of puts things in a very interesting perspective. You put priorities on things differently, and when you're you are faced with your mortality, you kind of have to decide what's important and what's not important. So I'm glad to hear that you're taking good care of yourself, and of course every time you go to the yoga you take my name, so I'm good with that.
Yes, I'm sure you are. There should be some sort of royalty going your way.
I know, but hey, if it's good for the planet, I'm good with that.
Exactly. Well, the non-monetary benefit and karma is way better than the monetary. No, I mean, for me, it's been helpful, extremely helpful, and a combination of things, right? Diet, exercise, walking, and just a positive frame of mind. But you're absolutely right. It's when you're faced with mortality, you think back to the life, or what I would say, lives we've had, right? Because we've all led various lives. I'm sure you led one life as a child, then you led another life as that budding journalist who wanted to leave India and come to the Western world, and then you led a life as a junior writer or journalist when you were in New York, then you led your life in Silicon Valley, and then you led your life in various. So I think we all lead lives, and for me, I've led so many amazing lives, and all of them have so many amazing journeys as part of them, and many regrets and many non-regrets, and we all are who we are today because of the lives we've led. And it's a great way to reflect on these things. I'm sure we'll talk about these things later, but to give you an example today, I had to see a friend of mine this morning, and then I had some spare time, and I was on the east side of London, close to what's now Shoreditch, or referred to as the Hip Quarter, but actually Whitechapel, Aldgate East. Now, this is an area where, as a 11, 12, 13-year-old child living in very working-class environments in the suburbs of East London, Essex, I used to work after school, weekends, on summer holidays, and I remember my starting pay was 75 pence an hour, and eventually it went up to £1.25 an hour, and it was really interesting. I went back there today because I remembered the other day that 11-year-old boy with dreams, right, with one pair of trousers aside from my school uniform, which we'd got on welfare, the DSS, because we couldn't afford for me to be able to buy that, one pair of trousers with the holes, going to and from these factories and sweatshops. But dreaming's like, and those dreams were different. Those dreams were, hey, will we ever own our own home? We lived in a home which was paid for by welfare. My father, God bless him, he was late 60s, but he was still trying to work as a driver's assistant loading boxes so we could have that better life. My mother was cleaning toilets in a baker's every day. So, you know, I went back there to kind of not lose touch with that 11-year-old boy with those dreams, because those dreams were fulfilled a long time ago. But I never want to be at that stage where I completely forgotten what that life was like. And the fact that I'm privileged enough to be able to having this conversation with you about it, just it kind of sums it up.
You know, the great thing about our tech industry is that no one really cares where you come from. And you know, yes, there is a lot of, you know, negative stuff about it. But I think your case and my case, and I've multiple times I've come across people, you know, whose past can be confounding, and yet there they are, and, you know, trying to live the life on their own terms. Now, tell me, were you born in United Kingdom, or were you born in Pakistan?
I was born in United Kingdom. I was born in a small town in the northwest of the country called Nelson, Lancashire, next to Burnley. It's a very industrial little village, actually. And he had a huge Pakistani community because in the 50s and 60s, a lot of the cotton mills were based there. And, you know, Lancashire cotton is still regarded as some of the finest cotton, and obviously manual labor and immigrant population from Pakistan settled in various pockets around the UK. And one of those was the Nelson, Blackburn, Preston area. So, you know, small town in, I guess, post-industrious Great Britain. And I was born there. But very quickly, we moved, not that I remember it, but when I was 6 months old, we as a family, we moved to Denmark.
Oh, wow. That's just a move I did not see happening.
Not many people see that. And part of it, I think, blame the Spotify crew for this, because, you know, them being Swedes in the early days, I was very proud and go, hey, you know, I'm Danish. And they go, Shaq, just tell people you're Scandinavian. And they're like, you don't need to have to keep on shouting to people, and especially Swedes. We're not too impressed by the fact that you're Danish. So, but no, from the age of 6 months to the age of about 10 or 10 and a bit, we lived in Denmark, just outside Copenhagen city center. And for the Danes who are on your listenership, we lived in a place called Ishøj, then we lived in a place called Glostrup and Brøndby, and then we lived in a place called Valby Langegate, which is very close to the center of Copenhagen.
And so what took your family there?
Well, you know, when you're immigrant manual workers, you basically have left the mountains or the farms or the hills of whichever country you are, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, you know, that region, and you've left that life for a better life. So whether it's, you know, the cotton mills of Lancashire or the paint factories of Copenhagen, hey, you're willing to work to be paid, you know, some monetary value for the work that you're doing, so you and your family can hopefully have a better life. And you've been given an opportunity. So I believe, I never obviously had this deep conversation with my father because he passed away by the time I really became an adult as such. You know, the opportunities were probably more economical and beneficial, and the living conditions were probably better in Denmark at the time, and hence why we moved. And again, I think you'll see from coming from Pakistan to England is a long way. Going from England to Denmark, it's really not that far, right?
Wow. And then you guys moved back to England. And
We moved back. Actually, it's interesting. We moved back to Nelson for a few months. I enrolled in school in the Northwest for a few months. And then we moved to London because, again, hey, you know, there weren't many jobs there. And in the 80s, industry was, I guess, very much on the decline. And London was this big city. And I guess our father thought, hey, you know, the future looks rosier down south. So let's go and try and make a life for ourselves. But we had no money and we had no contacts. And there was no social media or people who we could phone up or etc. So it was a struggle. I remember, being at the welfare office with my mother and father as a 10-year-old child.
Now, did your parents speak English at that time?
No, both my parents were obviously first generation Pakistanis who'd come over here, first generation immigrants. Both unfortunately illiterate, couldn't read or write. My father spoke a bit of, I'm sure you know what I mean. The working man English, but not an educated in the sense of, had gone to school, etc., etc., but could get by in life of the essential parts of life. And my mother, unfortunately, no, never learned to speak or read or write English.
So, being older than you are, I'm very familiar with, the past of England, which was very racist, both in the 70s and the 80s, is the time you must have been growing up as a kid. Did that have any impact on you growing up, especially in East London? And it was not a good time to be in England at that time.
Well, I think
Especially
there's
if you
two.
were not white.
So I was going to say, I think there's two things, right? Being non-white and also being poor, right? The two don't go. The two don't help the cause, right? So, there are non-whites who lived in areas where, racism was far less than other areas, right? And middle class areas and educated people. But when you live in very working class areas, they unfortunately tend to breed certain level of ignorance, which I believe is in most cases what most people confuse as racism, right? It's ignorant of something different. And I think we're seeing it today, right? You look at the world today, whether it's the USA or UK or parts of Europe, and we're seeing this whole this coming full circle on us. Jobs are tough. People aren't making enough money as they, in certain cases, had hoped or feel they're entitled to. And it's very easy to blame the Romanian or to blame the Polish or to blame anyone who's different than you. In the 80s and 70s in the UK or Great Britain, it was basically blame the blacks, blame the Irish, and blame the Paccies, right? And that's the life that people were living. So I remember those days fondly. I had a great childhood, innocent life as such. But I remember the first time somebody spat at me and called me a Paccy, and I had no idea why would a grown man spit at me or call me a Paccy? It just didn't make sense. As a child, you can't process that. When we were living in London, after a while, we moved to a town called Dagenham, and Dagenham's a very, very, very working class town on the suburbs of London. It was actually built for Ford workers. It was an industrial town. The Ford Motor Company had a huge, huge plant there, and it was built for its workers. And it was the home, to an extent, of BNP, the British Nationalist Party. Is a very, very racist town. And I kid you not when I say, the first 3 months of us moving there, I think I had to fight either on the way to school or on the way home from school every single day. I had to have some sort of fight with another kid older than me or my age who was different, who saw me as being different. And to make it worse, I had a very strict father who, if I went home and I had had a fight, whether I had lost or whether I had won, he didn't care. He was going to beat me up again. So that's what life consisted of, right? This is the life you lead. And I'm sure you've heard this story before. People don't like talking about it, but that's the life of a lot of people that we know. And I'm sure there are people who've got it 10 times as worse than us right now.
It was a funny thing. I was in London for maybe 2 months, 3 months, and I went to places like Birmingham, Manchester. I was trying to do some stories about the Bhangra movement and stuff like that. And man, it was, even as a tourist, I felt the racism. So I can't even imagine what it was like for somebody like you growing up. in that environment. Now, all that, you know, stressful environment as a kid growing up, you know, in an environment where you're fighting on the streets and getting beat up at home, does that turn you into like a full-on computer nerd? Do you and you hide in your room and just study and, you know, like what the classic Spider-Man?
Mine is very different. I didn't actually switch on a computer till I think 1996 maybe. I was 22 years old. No, I was very different, right? We had no phone at home. We had a TV, we had no video, very strict, right? And obviously economically we couldn't afford a lot of these things. There was no computers or anything at all at home. So it was basically, you know, me with my dreams, as I was telling you about earlier on, and survival skills, right? So I learned survival skills. So survival allowed me to stay alive there and then. Dreams allowed me to stay alive for the future. Do you see where I'm coming from there?
Yeah.
Both go hand in hand, right? Survival was, hey, I need to live through another day without getting beaten up or, you know, just getting home. And the dreams was tomorrow will be better than today. And then tomorrow then became next week. And it was always one day, right? One day. And I realized, you know, hey, I realized very early on, and, you know, I didn't have any mentors, et cetera. I kind of like, you know, had this long conversation with life and going, hey, you know, one day the only one who can help you is you. So do what it takes. And, you know, it was tough, right? It was tough. Everything from, like I said, working in factories, you know, I was 12 years old. But, you know, I don't regret it. It made me the man who I am today, you know, going up and ringing a doorbell off a factory in Aldgate East E1 and going, hi, do you have any jobs? And the foreman looking at me going, yeah, but who for? And I was like, me. And he's like, aren't you supposed to be at school? And I was like, I can do evenings and weekends and holidays. So it taught me great skills and people skills. And you realize, hey, you know, the world is run on people. So I think there's that. On the flip side, you know, hanging out with bad crowds because you have this anger. You're like, hey, you know, why am I different to everyone else? Why don't we have money? Why don't we have a nice car? You know, gang culture takes place and you end up associating with probably other people who are going through the same anger and hate as you are because you feel in some shape or form, one, you don't have the opportunities or two, the opportunities aren't being presented to you the way they are other people.
So did you figure out, you know, your way forward? Did you make, you know, all that hanging out with people who were, I would just say, nefarious people or people who were in similar circumstances as you are, did that have an impact on your life? Did you do anything you wish you hadn't?
So, you know, as I mentioned earlier on, we all have various lives. You know, I'm quite at peace with myself these days. And, you know, I reflect a lot on, hey, what could I have done differently? And what are some of the things I remember? So I'll share with you something which I've, you know, not shared with many people because I've never felt it to be relevant. But now looking back at it, you know, it's something which crops up going, hey, that was, you know, that was a challenging time. So, you know, one, I left home. I ran away from home on my 16th birthday. I believe everyone was asleep or, yeah, I'm pretty sure everyone was asleep. My older brother had given me a stern telling off. It was my birthday. And I don't know, for some reason or another, I actually think he'd caught me smoking weed the day before, right? And, you know, that was a big no-no. And he's probably slapped me or whatever. And I was angry and I ran away from home. And I didn't go back for a number of years. And that's the first time I experienced what the real world was like, because all along, you know, it's like, hey, one day I'll go and make it in the big wide world. And then you realize big wide world is very cold. And, you know, unless you've got people, it becomes a very difficult place. So I slept on the streets. A memory I remember every day, because I live very central in London these days. And very often, most days or every couple of days, I walk on Oxford Street, and this was the street where I used to sleep in a shop doorway. And, you know, I was a homeless individual, the type that I'm sure you and I see out there and many people choose to ignore on a daily basis. You know, I was that individual. I remember once I hadn't eaten for a couple of days and I was in a park and I walked up to a gentleman and I said, "Excuse me, do you have 50 pence? And he kind of looked at me and, you know, brushed me off as you do. It's like, "Hey, why are you bothering me?" He kind of said to me, "I'll get lost." And I took a couple of steps and then I turned back around. I said, "Sorry to bother you again." He said, "What do you want now?" I said, "Okay, if you don't have 50 pence, do you have a slice of bread?" And he looked at me, he said, "You really must be hungry." I said, "No, I haven't eaten for 2 days." And, you know, he gave me a pound or whatever and I went and got some food. So, you know, I remember that. I've never, ever forgotten that. That's one part. The other part is, you know, I did many things I regretted. You know, I stole cars, right? I think the first time I got arrested was for stealing cars or car stereos because, hey, at the time, you know, I had to survive, right? So, you know, I got arrested, not a proud thing, but that's the life I was leading at the time, right? You know, you're trying to do survival and you do a lot of things which, if you now look back at, you know, what was I thinking? But it happens, right? So, you know, one side sleeping rough on the streets, no food, begging for money. On the other side, you know, breaking into cars and stealing cars. These are all things which, you know, 25, 26 years ago seemed like, hey, well, that seems like a good idea. Looking back at it now, it was quite a bad idea at the time. So I hope that answers at least something off it. And that, you know, you then go, okay, this, you know, this is how life's going to be. And then you start thinking, okay, well, I don't have to live like this. Maybe I could do something else. So I got involved in the nightclub scene. And with the nightclub scene, you know, comes organizing great parties, but then comes, you know, the consumption of illegal substances. And, you know, you think, hey, well, hey, I could make some money here. So, you know, is that a time I look back at fondly? You know, I had great times at the time, but, you know, I also, you know, made some money smoking or actually, you know, smoked some drugs and to pay for that, sold some drugs. And, you know, that was the kind of life I led. It's interesting, the learnings from those days. And, you know, again, not a period I am happy with because that ended quite badly and I got arrested and, you know, put in what's known as young offenders, you know, when you're under 21 or whatever, there are certain places that they send individuals to. And I ended up going there. And unfortunately, I was there when my father passed away on my 20th. You know, I was 20 years old at the time. And my father passed away with me incarcerated. So, yeah, hey, do I regret things and times? Absolutely. If I could turn the clock back, would I? Absolutely. But the reality is, I am who I am today, probably because of those journeys.
And so what made you switch from what you were? Because it seemed like you were in a pretty dark place and you could have gone deeper. So what helped you change from that place?
You know, I did a lot of reading over the years, especially in the time that, you know, when I was homeless. The wonderful thing is the British has an amazing library system and I kept my library card. So I'd go and get books. I kid you not, I would read, right? I would read because I realized like I need a way out. I never finished my high school. I didn't finish GCSEs, but I tried reading as much as I could. I read the time that I was, you know, put away. I did a lot of reading on everything I possibly could. And then, you know, when my father passed away and I came home, I realized I want to make a better life for myself. But, you know, for a long time, for many years, I carried that emotional baggage with me of, oh, you know, blame the world, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, a few friends along the way helped me out. Family friends lent me some money to get started. And, you know, I guess that was the different trajectory of, hey, I could use my brain and, you know, the smartness I think I am on the street. If I apply that in other areas, how will that work out? And yeah, I mean, then, It's just been kind of nonstop work, and it was 15 years of, I guess, 7 days a week, 18-hour days of just working nonstop in whatever I did. And I was in mobile phones for a while, where I used to buy secondhand phones and repair them, and basically get on a plane from London and go to Dublin and walk up and down the streets and sell those phones. That was fascinating, but again, I saw the opportunity before anyone else, and hey, that was a great little business in the mid 90s and late 90s, and then the internet came along and everything else changed, right?
So how did you end up with on the internet, and involved in the internet?
So I think 1999, around 1998, the big companies had got into the mobile phone space. You had a big car phone warehouse, Tesco's were selling phones, and I realized this world of the independent dealer, which happens, and by the way, as most industries, right, there's always a few years of an arbitrage opportunity where there are market inefficiencies and nothing is standardized, but then there's time to make large amounts of capital at that time as such, and then you have to find something else at times. So I was reading, and the internet, everyone's talking about it. So, oh, this seems interesting. I need to learn more about it. And then I started a company, and it was a domain name company, which did okay. Then I launched a SMS service where you could send free text messages online. That did okay. And then the crash happened, and I lost everything. But I'd learned enough about customer acquisition and online marketing by then. And then I launched a company which was basically an online healthcare company called ActiveMed. Sold weight loss, hair loss products, impotence products. So basically Viagra on the internet. And did that for a couple of years. Great, again, great business, but it wasn't something which I wanted to spend the whole of my life doing. I learned a lot about ROI tracking and keyword analysis and conversion rate optimization through that. And then, did some affiliate stuff. And by the way, a lot of the people who I'm sure you'll come across in the internet world started off in the affiliate world of acquiring traffic, whether it was SEO, SEM. Did that, and then I went traveling around the world, ended up in China, moved to China, lived in China for just under 2 years, learned some Mandarin, traveled around a bit, learned about the Chinese internet, had no money as such, which to deploy in investments, and I never invested. Came back, started another company with some friends, which we ended up selling, and then that got sold to AOL. And this is around the 2007 period where then the Spotify journey starts.
So what is the company which you sold to AOL? Sorry.
So I had a consumer finance lead generation company called Lightstate that was acquired by an affiliate network called Buyat, who then sold that to AOL because they wanted to buy an advertising slash affiliate platform in Europe. They'd actually tried buying TradeDoubler, which was Martin Lorentzen, who's the co-founder of Spotify's company, but that deal fell through, so they ended up buying our company instead.
Oh, wow. I mean, so there's a certain group of people who are going to say that even that part of the business is also a little bit shady, right? Like the lead gen and customer acquisition and whatnot. I mean, what do you say
I
to
mean,
that?
if you say that, then you may as well say the internet's shady, and Google's the biggest, shadiest
Well, hell
operator in the
yeah.
world.
I mean,
Hey, online traffic, right? So, was I? Yeah, I would actually disagree. I get where you're coming from there on, but hey, is Amazon shady because it offers you the best choice of information? If you're servicing a need. Where you can offer a better product than the incumbents, you can offer choice, you can stop being people ripped off, and in return, you get some sort of commission. Hey, sorry, isn't that Booking.com? Isn't that Expedia? Isn't that TripAdvisor? And every other company that we see on a daily basis who actually have a revenue model, right?
Yeah, well,
I know you're an idealist, and if it was down to you, there'd be no paid search traffic, but somebody has to pay the server bills.
Well, I think I'm not, like, I'm not a, you know, I'm a pragmatist on all these things. I just am, I'm just kind of saying, you know, I have a very highly skeptical view of, you know, the Legion and all that kind of stuff. But that just is me, and me being the old-time internet guy, that's why. You know, I can't help that. Like, that's who I am. And, you know, there is so much to, like, parse there. And there is so much about you I had no idea. Because I always knew from 2007 onwards, like, you and Spotify. So to hear about your journey, it is like, to, you know, the thing is, I was listening to it, I was like, wait, is this a rap song or is it a real story?
No, you know, it's funny you actually say the 2007, because I don't know if you know this. I think you do, because you're a smart man. You actually met Daniel Ek before I did, right? And in the world of the internet, of course, Daniel's, you know, in his mid-30s now. He obviously was very much based in Sweden until about 2007, but I think you met him in 2006 or whatever when he was involved in a previous company called Stardoll.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's been a fascinating journey, and, you know, hey, let's see where the rest of it goes. But yeah, you know, 2007, by then, if you look at it, part of me was actually, and the reason why it's interesting talking about that phase is, you know, all those dreams, Orm, all those dreams as a kid, you know, hey, you know, will we ever have a house? Will I, you know, ever get anywhere in life? Will I ever be able to have a successful business? And then, you know, getting into trouble with the police, right? And in reality, you know, yeah, I may make light of it because it's 25 years ago, but if you talk to somebody else, they may say to you, hey, Orm Malik, did you know your friend Shaq is a convicted criminal and he was a drug dealer? Why would you want to associate yourself with somebody like that? I mean, that's the reality of society that we live in, right? All of those things having gone through by 2007, right? I traveled the world, I'd lived in China, I'd come back, I'd sold a company, and I'd made what to me was real money, like, you know, wealth type money, not just, hey, I made 20 grand, but real, you know, I'd had an exit, right? Single digit millions off an exit. And hey, this was so far from my dreams that it was very difficult to process because I had never, ever thought that day would ever happen.
Wow. I mean, you know, look, there is two ways to think about it. I would say, you know, the past is what it is, and you've embraced it, it seems like it, and you're openly willing to talk about it and not hide it. To me, that is more important. I would think
I don't think there's anything to
hide,
right?
I
am who I am, Orm, and you know, why hide it, right? Why hide it? I don't think it's got any relevancy to who I am now, 20 years or 25 years later, you know. We often look back. I mean, what are the regrets? Some of those things, you know, I regret not being able to spend time with my father in his, you know, last few days and when he passed away, right? For not being there, for being that son who was in trouble and who wasn't living at home. I regret that. I regret the pain, I'm sure, that my mother went through all those sleepless nights that, hey, you know, I have a son who isn't home. And I actually think she was probably more going through pain when I was homeless and living on the streets, because I heard from people that she'd heard I'm living on the streets, not when, you know, I'd been in trouble, because, hey, the police station, and they actually, you know, feed you, right? So there's a lot of regrets, but, you know, looking back at it now, there isn't much I can do, so why hide it, right? And, hey, are me and you going to stop being friends because somebody says to you, hey, Orm, your friend is a convicted criminal? Probably not, right?
Well, you know, the past is what it is. I always have said, and I think a lot of people don't quite get it, that what we don't have as a child always has a long-term impact on us in our life. I think this is the heart, you know, it's not what we have, but it's what we don't have. And we don't realize it till very late in life why those things, you know, and how those things have worked out. So I'm glad things have worked out for you, you know. It's like it could have gone pretty wrong. You could have been dead. You could have been, you know, stabbed, murdered. You could have done even more evil things than, you think you did. Like, you know, it was drugs, and at least you didn't become a full-on gangster. And here you are, like you put yourself in this position.
I think, looking back at a lot of these things a few years ago, I think another thing which most people try not to talk about is depression, right? And mental illness, you know, and especially when you come from very working class background, but also certain countries, as you know, in Pakistan, India, you don't talk about mental illness. So you just deal with it, block it up, whether it's yourself or a family member or whatever, you just block it up. But a few years ago, you know, I realized, hey, maybe I should go and, you know, get some, or maybe sometimes I think it was part of like, hey, you know, it'd be nice just to have somebody to talk to. And I spent a lot of time with a therapist and going through a lot of my early youth and childhood and, you know, my father's death and being homeless and the privileged life I lead now. And I remember a therapist saying to me, you know, it's quite fascinating that you came here off your own free will, because everything that you've told us points to two things. You should have either been in a graveyard or you should be in jail doing 25 years. And here you are sitting here in a chair, and you walked in through this door yourself because you're willing to seek help. So, you know, life works in mysterious way, Om Sahib. You know, it's an interesting journey we're on. And coming back to where you started on, many lives make one life.
Yeah. You know, you were talking about Daniel and I. The reason Daniel and I clicked was because, you know, he's a very soft-spoken guy, keeps to himself and has a very long-term game plan on everything. And I think in many ways, he and I kind of have a little bit of overlap in personalities, in a sense. We both think about the long-term, and we always have this whole thing around, look at all my close friends, who I think of them as close friends, whether it is, you know, Matt Mullenweg, folks like Jack Dorsey, you know, I think of them as compassionate capitalists, and Daniel falls into that category of like not just take. So for me, it was a different funny relationship with him, because I was building GigaOm in an office right next to the office he was sitting in, trying to figure out the first version of Spotify, which was coincidentally, people don't remember that, was supposed to be, you know, share songs with your friends by dropping them on a Spotify, you know, icon on your desktop, and it was a peer-to-peer music system. And it's very different than what it is today. What made you click with Daniel? And so, how did the two of you meet?
We have a mutual friend, a very dear friend of ours called Jimmy Furland. And if you look at my Facebook picture for, I think, the last 8 years or 7 years, it's normally a version of the three of us together somewhere in a picture. The latest one is from, I think, 6 months ago. So me and Jimmy had been friends from, you know, an internet forum called Webmaster World. He's Swedish. He'd been friends with Daniel from Sweden. And the two of us met in 2007, just at a dinner. And, you know, it was fascinating listening to Daniel, how he saw the world and where the world was headed. And he was obviously, asked me what I'd been doing. And I said, oh, I've just spent the last couple of years living in China. And he's like, oh, wow, why would you go to China? And I'm like, why not? I'm not a technologist, right? I would like to think if there's one thing I understand, it's marketing and human psychology and people. And Daniel was fascinated by that. And then he was like, what are you doing now? And I told him, and, what we were working on. And I think the sale had just happened or it was happening. And then we became friends. And as you remember, the early days of Spotify were very different than they are now. And as he was getting started on that journey, he used to come to London a lot and we became friends. And he used to, after a while, I said to him, hey, why don't you stay in my apartment, right? Save you, running around from motel to bedsit to crappy hotel, as every startup founder has to go through in the early days when you have no money and you have to preserve every penny to keep your business alive. And that's how our friendship formed, and it's a 10-year friendship, and it's been one of the most amazing journeys anyone can go on.
And so how did you end up working at Spotify? I mean, I don't see you as a person who can fit into the 9-to-5 gig.
Yeah, I never really worked there. I don't think I've ever... I always say I've never worked, but then I always moan that I didn't work too hard. I started transitioning out a few months after that, after the sale, to AOL. And I was like, hey, what do I do? And think about it. I had my friend Daniel here, and he was trying to get this off the ground, and it was exciting, right? You know how it is. You've spent enough time with entrepreneurs, you get that entrepreneurial buzz, and this was the first time I got to experience it through somebody else. And so, if it was a meeting with an investor or a potential team member or whatever, I would come along. And, somewhere along the line, I started spending more time on Spotify than other stuff that I was doing, and just, tried helping where I could, right? And whether that was in recruitment or whether that was in marketing or user growth or giving out invites to people to try the service or trying to get journalists persuaded that they should give it a try to experience the product. That's how it got started. There was never anything formalized going, hey, this is what you're going to do and this is what you're not going to do. I kind of created a role for myself.
So can I ask one question? We've talked for a long time, but are you responsible for all the Indian music and Pakistani music and South Asian music on Spotify?
It's really interesting. I wish I could take that credit, but I can't. We have this unbelievable licensing team, and I have no idea how they get some of this music, so obscure. I listen to a lot of it, and I would always send in random stuff going, hey, you don't have any X artist, and they're from 1960, and they'd explain that, oh, we're trying to get licensing rights. But, it's fascinating how many people do listen to Punjabi music, how many people listen to Bhangra music. Lately, I've been listening to a lot of, old school Bhangra. And as you know, I've been a bit slow lately, although I've picked up in the last couple of weeks. I try and at least once a week send you a song on Twitter, which will take you back to the good old memories of the Punjabi days in your youth in dance club doing Indian John Travolta moves. So, it's again, moments, experiences, right? Music is such a wonderful thing, and it allows the two of us to connect from thousands of miles apart.
By the way, I do those John Travolta moves even now, just to be clear. Amazing. I'm waiting for your wedding to happen, so you will see it firsthand.
Absolutely. Well, hey, I'm sure you'll be right up on stage. You can even choose the song for your moves.
But let's talk about you. And now, after joining Spotify, you did some other stuff, like you left.
Yeah, so if you look at the last 10 years, and it's really interesting, right, Omar, and I'm mindful of time because you're a far busier man than I am. I would have thought the last 10 years were the most important, right? Career, Spotify, angel investing, et cetera, but then you look at it over a 43-year life, and, it's been a journey, and it's been very critical, but
I don't really spend too much time thinking about it these days because, yeah, you know, Spotify is amazing. I had a great experience, brilliant company, brilliant team, great friend who I'm still friends with to this day, as close as we've ever been, met some wonderful people, you know, did a bunch of investing, invested in, I think, 23 companies. And investing's tough, right? The reality is I got very, very lucky with Spotify. Yeah. And I'm just going to say it, right? Because I have zero desire to go out there and be joining a fund and going, hey, what's your track record? Spotify was my first ever investment. So when Daniel was staying here, I gave him some money, right? I had X amount of money. I gave him 50% of what I had and invested in Spotify. Rest is history. I shouldn't have ever done another investment. But, you know, you start thinking, hey, I'm good at this, right? I'm not good at it. I'm just lucky, right? And a bit crazy because no sane person should ever give anyone 50% of their money on a crazy angel investment. But, hey, it worked out for me. Yeah, so a bunch of angel investments. I had great fun, you know, working with entrepreneurs from around the world, helping them navigate various challenges, building companies, work for a number of professional investors, helping their portfolios, mentoring some of their companies. One of them who you remember very clearly was Nick DeLoisio, the 16-year-old English kid who started Sumly, who you wrote about. You know, that was an exceptional journey, right? It was so amazing to have the opportunity to work with an entrepreneur like that. That company got sold to Yahoo, had lots of these wonderful experiences. You know, student.com, Luke Nolan, the founder and CEO of that company, and I had met 10 years before in Shanghai. We used to learn Mandarin together, and he had started essentially an offline business called Overseas Student Living, helping Chinese students find accommodation. I'd mentored him whenever we'd try and catch up, or whenever he'd come over here, he'd spend some time with me and, you know, said, hey, you know, I think this is a far bigger opportunity that you may have realized. And we started what essentially became student.com, which is an online platform. We had to go out and raise, large amounts of money. And luckily, it's an industry a lot of people can see the long-term potential of. And whether that's Jim Breyer from Excel, who'd done the Facebook investment and also had spent a lot of time in China with the IDG group and understood how big China could be as a source, whether it's investors in Europe. People saw the opportunity and, you know, we started student.com. Unfortunately, two macro events happened, which meant that we had to, you know, possibly relook and rethink how we were focusing our resources and energies. Brexit happened, and when an event like Brexit happens, you see markets like China and a Chinese parent thinking, do I really want to send my child to a place like UK where they may not necessarily be welcome? Then after that, the US election happens, and that brings its own challenges. But hey, international students need to travel somewhere. So, you know, the business is running mainly based out of Shanghai now, focused on international students going around the world, and a lot of it ends up being in Asia. So that kept me busy for some of the time. And it, again, an amazing journey, right? And a long journey to go yet. Very happy to see, Luke stepping up now and, growing that team and the leadership taking place. So yes, last 10 years have been exceptional in terms of learning, but I don't define my life by them. And I think it took the heart attack for me to realize that, hey, you need to think a lot more about what maybe the next 43 years are going to be about versus what the last 10 or the last 43 were about.
So can I go back to the start and talk to you about, like, how's your relationship with your family now? Are you close to your mother? Do you see her often? How's, like, I know how, you know, Desi families are, and when you're the son who leaves, you leave a lot of scars on the heart.
Yeah. You know, the reality is this, I left home at 16, but I'd kind of been on my own since the age of 10, right? Because I was pursuing my survival and I was pursuing my dream. So if you look at it, I'm 43 now, you know, more than 75% of my life has been me as an individual, right? You know, in the wide world. So yes, I have a family who I love, but do we have much in common? Unfortunately not. You know, they live their life very much the way they want to, and I live my life very much the way I want to. And what I chose, how I choose to live, I wish I could turn the clock back and had got closer and spent more time. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. You know, I try and make up for it where I can these days. I think that's one of the regrets, and that was one of the prices that I had to pay. And especially, you know, maybe not the last 10, but the previous 15, where it consisted of 7 days a week and 12 hours or 18 hours a day at work to achieve the goals which I wanted to achieve, and both for myself and for my family. So,
do you think that, you know, growing up the way you did, does it force you to become, you know, more closed as a person, that you only don't have deeper relationships with others because you grew up, you know, like looking out for yourself all the time? I mean,
you know, everyone's living in a different circumstance. And, you know, there's a great line I saw, and I try and share that everyone's like, everyone who you meet is fighting a battle of their own, right? I can only talk about how I lived my life. Did I live it as a closed person? No. Did I live it as a very open? I didn't have the time, and I maybe didn't have the energy, and I didn't know how to, right? So, because in those days, and I don't mind sharing this with you, Om, when I would say, oh, you know, one day I'm going to do this, and, you know, one day we'll have a house. People in the neighborhood or the other kids on welfare would like literally go, how dare you, right? Because sometimes people try and bring you back down to it. They're like, how dare you think you can do that? You're going to be a bum just like everyone else out here. And I was like, no fucking way. I refuse to accept that. So, you know, that's the life I chose to lead, because that was a life I didn't want to lead. Right? I think that's the only way I can answer that.
So what next?
You know, I'm enjoying the yoga. I wish I could do more of it, but, you know, the studio I go to, they're very busy, so they don't have that many classes that I can just keep on crashing into. No, I'm really enjoying taking my foot off the pedal. I'm enjoying and getting fit, changing my diet. I'm enjoying walking a lot. I have a beautiful girlfriend who I get to spend a lot more time with now than I did before. I get to see my friends a lot more. They pass by London, and I actively try and go and make time to go and see them. So yeah, the short term is really very little work and very much taking care of everything that needs taken care of. And then, you know, let's see, right? Let's see what happens. Maybe in 2018. Again, I think I have a life to live ahead, and with some of the lessons from the past, you know, hopefully I won't make some of the mistakes that I made 20 years ago or 25 years ago, and I can, you know, go on to live an amazing life and try and be a good man and live a good life and try and help people where I may be able to help. And whether that's, you know, in organizations like Charity Water, who are giving people clean water around the world, whether it's places like Pencil of Promise, who are building schools in Laos and Cambodia and Ghana, whether it's, you know, there's a couple of organizations in London who very much work on the suicide helpline side of things. And, you know, I've had a very close family member who's had to go through various challenges, and, you know, they've been living their own nightmare. I've tried helping where I can there. Do I try and, you know, help get involved actively in one of these causes and, you know, try and, yeah, I mean, I just want to make sure that the next 43 years aren't as wasted as the previous 43 years. So I have a lot of things in the brain that I could focus on, but right now it's just about getting healthy, I guess.
All right. So some fun stuff I want to ask you. Your three favorite places to eat in London, which especially if they are Indian or Pakistani.
Okay, so I put desi food, and some people go, "What desi is?" So you'll have to explain what desi is. But for me, Marouche, and they're a chain. They have, I think, 12 or 14 restaurants. The one I specifically like is Marouche 5, Veer Street, V-E-R-E Street. It's between Debenhams and House of Fraser on a little side street off Oxford Street near Bond Street. I must have eaten in this place 600 times on the consistency of quality service, quality of food. Everything is just mind-blowing. I don't even know how they do it. I may have had, in those 600 meals, I may have had two bad meals in my life.
That's the Lebanese place, right?
That's the Lebanese place, Middle Eastern place. Unbelievable how good it is. Then the other one, and it's interesting, I hadn't been back there for years and years. And after I went and did my little walk down memory lane, I popped by, and it's a very, very famous Pakistani restaurant. It's been there since 1972, and it's called Tayyab's. And when I was a kid, on 75 pence an hour, I would go for my lunch break there, and they'd sell a kebab burger for 60 cents and I guess a can of Coke for 15 or whatever. And, you know, it's one of the best Pakistani meals you'll ever have in your life. And it's busy with every day of the week, and you've got all crowds. You've got the Pakistani family crowd, you've got the banker crowd from the Canary Wharf and the City of London, and you've got the hipster crowd. I mean, it's just so good, the quality, consistency, family cooked meals. So those two are great. And then, you know, then there's some high-end places. Salouz is one that I think is, in my opinion, one of the best places that does Pakistani Indian food anywhere in the world. Now, over the last few years, we've had some amazing new Indian places open up. Gymkhana is one, Trishna is another one, Tamarind Kitchen. These three are exceptional places. And then there's actually a new place which I'm very excited about opening up next month called Darjeeling Express in Soho. And I think this one's going to be exceptional. They're basing it on home-cooked food. And the chefs or people cooking the food is actually going to be home chefs, not professionals, but, you know, in a lot of cases, Asian home-cooked food. And so, you know, aunties who have been cooking for 25, 30 years, they will be coming and hosting different days with the master chef and cooking their favorite dishes.
Okay, that's great.
So you have to come visit for that.
I know. Though, I just am so, like, I'm just so tired of going through Heathrow. It's not a comfortable airport.
Yes.
Now, the last question for you. Your story of your life made into a movie. Amitabh Bachchan or Shah Rukh Khan?
What a question. I know Amitabh is old, right? So I don't know whether, he's the OG of OGs. I remember watching all his movies, and the movie which I remember most, and you'll know it, was the movie Kulli. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, the train station porter, right? So that Amitabh, absolutely. But then, you know, Shah Rukh is Shah Rukh, right? There's not many people who beat Han Sab there. So, hey, I hope there isn't a movie ever made about me, because I don't think it's worthy of a movie. But I am not worthy of either of the two of them. But I wouldn't complain if it was one of those two.
Dude, I got to tell you, man, I learned so much about you in this conversation. There was so much I didn't know about you, your struggle, your history, the obstacles you overcome. You know, there'll be some who might judge you, but to me, where you are is a testament of human spirit. And hopefully, you know, you keep succeeding in life, and next time, you know, we don't have to talk about heart attacks, and let's compare notes on how healthy we are.
Absolutely. And, I think that hopefully I'll be able to show you some new yoga moves that I've learned.
I don't want to talk about that. I don't do yoga. you know, it's like
that. Do it in spirit. I can do extra lessons for you, so we're all good there.
But like, I seriously, this was an amazing, you know, I had to, you know, mute often with my what? Like, I just like, there's a lot of what moments in this conversation. So much I did not know about you. So much of your struggle I did not know about. And sometimes I wonder if I really know you and if we will ever know you. But the glimpse into your life, thank you so much. You know, I mean, when I think about this occasional podcast, that's what I think about. I don't want to do conversations which are superficial. And I think we all have journeys we forget. I have actually never talked about the journey, you know, as much in my stories, because most people are always focused on the future. And I thought this may be a good way to think about where we are and where we have come from is also important. So,
well, I think, you know, what's really interesting, Orman, you know, there's so much that one could talk about this, but an easy way to sum it up, we can kind of control where we are going. We can't go back and change who we are and where we came from.
Yep.
And to then embracing it, why fight it, right? And, you know, the reality is this, I was laying in an operating theater 5 months ago, and, you know, I was ready to go and meet my maker, right? I was ready to go up or down or wherever it is you're supposed to go and go and answer for my life. And I've been given an opportunity and I want to make the most of it. And the one thing I remember there lying, it's a very cold place, those operating theaters. And I remember lying there and being angry with myself and saying to myself, this is not how it was supposed to end. You know, I refuse to let it end like this. Like, this is not how it's supposed to end. And, you know, I got a second shot. So, yeah, you know, the past is what it is. I can't do nothing about that. But hopefully I can make decisions going forward, which will be, you know, look back and go, hey, those were some good decisions. That was a good life.
All right, my brother. Good luck with everything. And thank you for making time today, and we'll talk soon.
Take care, Om. Thank you.